Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, with wildlife traffickers pushing some species to the brink of extinction, we explore the multi-billion dollar a year industry. What is the scope of the problem and what should be done to rescue our most endangered species? But first, with climate change upon us, the Earth is changing the way it functions. What exactly is occurring and where are we headed? Scientists say the Earth is changing more rapidly than we have expected. Ecosystems are shifting and some species are dying out. What does this mean for humanity? Larry Schweiger is with us. Larry Schweiger is the president and CEO of the National Wildlife Federation and the author of Last Chance, Preserving Life on Earth. Welcome, Larry Schweiger.
Good to be here.
It's great to have you here. So your book, Last Chance, Preserving Life on Earth, was 5 years ago. Since then, we've had a lot of science. I think you said something like 37% of species would be extinct by 2050.
50.
Is that still happening?
We're still on course for continued extinctions. In fact, the latest I've seen is 40 to 70% of the species, according to the path that we're currently on.
By 2050?
Well, by the end of the century, they'll be on the road to extinction is the way I characterize it in the book. And that pattern is continuing. And because we're adding more carbon to the atmosphere today than we were then, almost nearly double what we're putting in the air, the speed of this is picking up, and that's has everybody alarmed. Instead of reducing carbon emissions, we're increasing carbon emissions.
Now, one of the things that struck me was that the IPCC said that even though our economics were in decline, that the carbon has, what, doubled since 2000?
Because of what's happening, particularly in China, China has just blown right by the United States in terms of carbon emissions. But we all need to remember that they're making products for us. Our industry has unfortunately moved to China, and they are making manufacturing products largely for America and for South America and elsewhere. But we're the largest customer that they have. You know, we're still contributing to that problem.
So let's talk about that then a little bit. I know that part of the problem with China is coal. Mm-hmm. And I know we have something like 1,000 coal plants that are on track to be built now. I mean, that's like what's coming, the new coal plants. A lot of those are in China.
Yeah, it's really sad that we're continuing to build coal plants anywhere in the world. It doesn't make sense. The World Bank finally has decided it's not going to be funding coal plants anymore. But it's not a prudent investment. We're making these investments. They're going to be around for 30 to 50 years, and they're going to be polluting at a very, very high level. The Earth just simply cannot afford to have that kind of carbon pollution.
Now, you say it's not a good investment. Of course, it's not a good investment environmentally, but it's cheap. Isn't that why you see them going up in the countries such as India and China?
I also think it's bad economic investment because the world is heading to a very disrupted climate. And as that becomes increasingly painful and more clear, they're going to have to wean themselves off of those dirty coal plants. And in my view, the best thing we should be doing right now is investing in wind, solar, efficiency, and a lot of other renewable energy technologies to get us off of this dependence on dirty fuels.
I would like to get into some of that. And I know that there has been quite a bit of movement in some of the cities, like Los Angeles is really getting more and more involved in solar. But let's go back to your book, because you've broken this down in a way that's kind of interesting. There's one chapter where you say victims, perpetrators, and enablers. So let's talk about, first of all, one of the perpetrators you said was really these invasive species, which are getting worse because of climate change. Can you help us understand where it's happening and what are these invasive species and how is it connected to climate?
Well, first of all, when you change the climate, you alter the ecosystems. You can't save an ecosystem unless you save the sky over the ecosystem. So as these systems warm up and change, dry out, other species begin to move in as the original species disappear. And we're seeing that pattern. Rivers, for example, are overheating. So we're losing our cold water fisheries. They're being replaced with warm water fisheries. And in some cases, with invasive species from other continents that are finding their way into these habitats. So endangered species, threatened species, and invasive species all are altered by the changing climate. And unfortunately for the endangered species, it's most often that they disappear.
Can you give us some other examples of ecosystems in which there would be an endangered species that's being threatened by an invasive one?
The one that comes quickly to mind is what's happening to our oceans. We're acidifying our oceans. And so if you're a shellfish or a finfish or phytoplankton, for that matter, you need to use calcium in order to thrive, in order to prosper. And so as these systems are being altered with acidic waters, coral reefs, for example, are in decline in a number of places because of high temperatures as well as high acidity. So that's an example of an entire ocean system that's being stressed.
And the coral reefs, of course, that's a bit of a double whammy because they're like forests. They're supposedly like the lungs of the ocean.
Exactly.
So then it makes the climate worse.
And on the terrestrial side, what's happening to moose is really a good indicator. Moose are disappearing from places like New Hampshire and parts of Maine and New England. And also they've collapsed in Minnesota. The Minnesota moose population has dropped 60% because moose are a cold weather species. And as insects move in, particularly ticks, it takes a big toll on the moose. And we've seen those declines on the southern border of the moose populations.
I think it was also in the IPCC report talking about how so many animals that are cold water animals and other species are moving more and more to the north. But then there are some that really just don't have anywhere to go.
Exactly. That's true on mountains, too. The species that live in high mountain systems are being pushed further and further up the mountain and eventually will not have a place to go. You know, interestingly, Rachel Carson back in 1950 detailed the changing patterns of wildlife and plants and fisheries and birds. She saw climate change because she saw wildlife moving further north and further south on the planet and also further in the oceans further north. So wildlife have been a great indicator of climate change for a long time. We just haven't been listening to them.
That was back in 1950. That's right. I had today's article in The Guardian, I believe it was, talking about just things like butterflies that would normally be common in somewhere like Britain, gone from there and moved onward. And then the animals like the polar bears. Mm-hmm. You've talked about them in the book. They're not the only ones, of course, mm-hmm. that need the Arctic ice to survive.
Well, I visited Churchill last winter and saw the bears. And bears are losing weight year by year because there's not enough ice for them to get out and feed. So they delay their access to the ice, which is where they really get their food. And they scratch around for food on shore, but they don't get very much. And they really need the ice.
How thin is the ice now? I mean, is it just all but disappeared?
The ice has contracted quite substantially. There's great graphs that show that. Last year, it bounced back a little bit, and everybody got all excited about it. But it's truly on a downward path. And there's one study that suggested we have an 80% chance of being ice-free in the Arctic by 2030. We just watch it year by year, and you can see it shrinking away. And that's incidentally altering the weather patterns. You know, this polar vortex that we've experienced in the east, it's made it colder. Here in California, it's made it drier. But clearly, we're in a pattern that is not typical because the Arctic ice is rapidly disappearing.
The droughts are also changing ecosystems considerably, and you're seeing a lot of wildlife moving closer and closer to the cities.
Exactly. I think one of the most troubling trends is the number of very large forest fires. The number of large forest fires in the West has doubled in the last decade. And the Forest Service is predicting yet another doubling of the forest fires. Last year, they spent half of their entire budget fighting forest fires. So here's an agency charged with managing the forest, and they're spending half of their money just simply fighting fires. And, of course, we lost 19 firemen, forest firefighters, last year in Arizona. So these fires are hotter. And the other important thing about them is that they're burning the soil up. They're so hot that the soil, the humus in the soil gets burnt out. And therefore, it's very, very hard to recover those forests once they've burnt that hot.
When the soil burns, then all of the...
All the seeds are gone. All the organic matter is gone. So you have mineral
soil. So all the life that was in the soil is killed.
And that's what happens when you have these super fires like that. And that's what we're seeing more of.
And then the animals, of course, come into the city. Like we had our famous bear here. I don't know if you followed our bear, Glenn Berrien. Is that happening in other cities as well with these animals moving in increasingly?
Wildlife are opportunists. And if they lose their original habitat, they're going to go searching for other habitats. And we're seeing that. I don't know the particular story of this bear. I heard about it, but I don't know what drove him to the city. But You know, young males will often move into a city as they're looking for some new territory. In the bear population, they tend to be the roamer.
Climate change is bringing about invasive species. What else?
On the good side, people are starting to understand that the system is more fragile. I think there's a growing understanding that our weather patterns are out of whack and that we've seen increasing storms. So I'm hopeful, personally, that we're going to see some political change. I think it's short term. It's looking ugly in Washington because the attitudes, particularly the Republican House members, is to do nothing. And I think that's going to catch up to them. They're on the wrong side of history. So I'm trying to hang on to hope on that. And I think that there's a growing number of businesses that see the need to put a price on carbon and to start shifting the energy production towards a clean energy source.
Do we see more of an industry coming up with the clean energy sources that we were talking about earlier, wind, solar?
Absolutely. I spoke at a forum in San Francisco at Oakland, and a young man came up to me. He's a student there, but he's starting a company to retrofit buildings with efficient light systems. And, you know, he and his buddies have about 30 employees now, and he's a college student. So I think there's a lot of really cool innovation going on, and certainly there's a number of companies that are doing well. I think Tesla has done extraordinarily well, has surpassed most people's understandings. SolarCity, First Solar, the wind industry itself has done extraordinarily well. They have unfortunately banged into a limit on their tax program that we have to accelerate the investment in wind. But we're hoping that we'll get that restored this year and more importantly, get a price on carbon.
So let's talk about a couple of these. You mentioned Tesla. I assume most people know about Tesla, but for those who don't, this is an electric car that has been named the best car. It's the safest. It's the best running car.
I think if you look at the founder of Tesla, Elon Musk, he is a person who throughout his life has said, I'm going to do that. And he's been involved in the development of SpaceX, which is now delivering cargo to the space shuttle, to the and replacing the space shuttle, I should say. Elon is a can-do person. He's currently building a factory for batteries to make batteries for the automobiles and
the electric cars.
And if you ride in a Tesla, as I have, they're just a magnificent car. I mean, the idea of having electric cars is that the motors on electric cars are very clean. They last a long time. They have high acceleration, tremendous control. They give you a fantastic ride, and he's proven that you can take them long distances, and that with the charging stations they're establishing all over the country, it's going to be a transformative technology. It's going to change the way we think about cars. They're clean. They can be driven on wind and solar. I mean, think about that. We can drive cars by using wind and solar.
He's also been involved with SolarCity, right?
Yes.
So, which enables people to put solar on their house.
Exactly.
And then they can charge their cars through their house,
right,
all on solar.
Right. So it makes it an inexpensive recharge, and I think it's a fantastic way to go, and I think we're going to see a lot more of that as he builds more cars. Certainly the prices will continue to come down.
I don't know if you're watching this or not, but are you seeing Tesla having an effect on the rest of the car industry?
Oh, I was talking to an engineer at General Motors, and he said, well, you know, we've been working on an internal combustion engine since the last century, he said, and we have an internal combustion engine that's barely 30% efficient. Electric motors start out at 90% efficient. He said, so I guess we can assume that the industry is going to be moving to electric. I think that's happening.
Do you think even the hybrids are going to fade away?
I think hybrids are going to get more sophisticated, but ultimately will break into electric cars.
Do you know if the Teslas have gone into other countries as well, or are they just mostly focused in the U.S.?
No, they're actually building a plant in one of the Norwegian countries. I'm not sure exactly where, but they're definitely building a plant. And I think they'll do very well in Europe because the price of gasoline is much higher in
Europe.
And
it's, of course, higher because they don't subsidize the oil industry in
exactly
the way that the United States does.
Exactly.
Just a reminder that you're listening to The Scholar's Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. We're speaking with Larry Schweiger, and he's the president and CEO of the National Wildlife Federation and the author of Last Chance. Stay tuned. Let's go to some of these policies that you're hopeful about.
Yeah.
We've not seen very much movement so far, not with the international community and not here in the U.S., because as you mentioned, we've had a lot of representatives that don't understand the climate issue. What kind of movement have you seen that gives you some sense that there will be policies?
I'm hopeful that the American public is going to drive this change. I don't put a lot of hope in the politicians getting there on their own. They don't understand it because they don't want to understand it. You know, if you look at where the money's coming from for elections, the incumbent industries, coal, gas, oil, are pumping a lot of money into these elections. And others like the Koch brothers putting enormous amounts of money into elections. And they also put an enormous amount of money into our media. So they have a real lockhold on politics and on media. But I think eventually the American public's going to figure out that we have a very serious problem. And I think it's starting to show through in a pretty dramatic way. I've been seeing more and more indications that people are getting that our climate system is being disrupted. And when you look at what's happening to California, for example, and the impact that it has on the food supplies of the country, we're seeing the same thing in Arizona and New Mexico and parts of Texas. And we're seeing these huge forest fires and tremendous storm events, what happened in Colorado last year, what happened in New York City. People are starting to connect the dots. And at some point, there's going to be a moment when they do not tolerate politicians who are pretending that this is not a problem.
You know, one of the things that I watch is when politicians put forward policies that they think will be popular, but they don't really do very much. They're sort of symbolic. And that's one of the things I fear. Even if, say, the majority come on board to put forward a climate bill, what will it really contain in it that is meaningful?
It's an interesting point. The climate bill that we moved through the House at the leadership of Nancy Pelosi, frankly, was a bill that had issues, but it was actually going to cut carbon emissions over time by 80%. And we got that bill to the Senate and installed that, you know, Senator Ted Kennedy's death replaced by Senator Braun. We lost, you know, the majority that we needed in order to pass the bill in the Senate. And so that bill died. But I think it's going to come back. There's a growing need or feeling a need. Even the senators themselves did an overnight filibuster recently where they talked all night. They literally stayed up all night talking about climate change. It was symbolic, but it was an indication that they're starting to see the pressures mounting and they're willing to stand up and talk about it. And I think you're going to see that more and more. And I think, as I said earlier, these shifts occur very quickly. You know, one day, you know, you can get away with saying stupid things about climate change, and the next day it catches up to you. I see that coming. I have hope that that will happen.
You mentioned the media just now. You also talked about it quite a bit in your book and about really how superficial the United States media have been and in its own way misinforming people about the climate issue. You know, we get an IPCC report and then they cover it. Al Gore comes out with his movie and they cover it and people start to understand things, but then you have ClimateGate. ClimateGate happens and then everybody goes, oh, science, you know, science is all rigged. So I wonder, when we think about informing people, you think they're connecting the dots. How are they managing to do this?
My personal view is that it's more through the social networks. It's more through organizing it on campuses. It's more through.
So it's the younger people.
So younger people primarily, but we're also seeing increasing numbers of women starting to understand that their kids' future is at risk, the things that they really love and care for. And so I think there's a loving leadership that's emerging, and I think you'll see more and more women stepping up. I also believe that the politicians are really reflecting what's currently happening, and they don't have a real long field of vision. They look to the next election. And I think they're hoping that they get by on the next election by telling a false story about climate change. And I think a few important elections can turn that around, where people reject a lawmaker because he or she has been on the wrong side of climate change. And I think a few of those kind of turning points will wake the others up.
That'll be interesting to see. One of the things that you wrote about in the book was about how mass media have been really trivializing American life and American politics, and that has created more problems with people understanding the environment and what's really going on with the issues. What is going on behind the scenes of the media that you think is leading to this?
The media at one point in time was required to create content that met a test called the Fairness Doctrine. Today, they're no longer required to do that. So we've seen a a decline, I think a very rapid decline in the overall content on media. And a good example for me is what I witnessed in the Gulf oil spill. There were a number of camera crews down there interviewing BP employees and a few watermen who were not able to fish. And I went around and asked them if they were out on the water, had they actually seen the spill, even though they're only 8-10 miles from some of the oil. They hadn't seen it. And the reason for it was that their companies wouldn't hire the boats to go out onto the water. And so we hired the vessels to take them out onto the water and showed them the damage that was being done. Every day we took the various camera crews out. And so most of what people saw on television was shot off of boats that we had rented so that the media could see the event.
So had you not done that, you, the leader of a nonprofit organization, all that people would have gotten would have been interviews with BP.
Talking heads. And BP footage, which is the other thing that happens. You know, BP flies at 30,000 feet and flies over the spill and says everything's under control. And that's the image that they were striving to achieve. We were effective, and so effective that BP hired a new media firm to come in and actually then paid all the watermen 6 months in advance and gave them a contract that was double what we could pay them. Plus, they paid for their gasoline every day. So they basically bought the boats off the water, and that's why the media stopped covering the spill. The spill was still going on. We just couldn't access boats because they had been hired away by BP, and they were having the boat captains sit on the docks. They were paying them to sit on the docks.
A couple things I can draw from this. One is that journalists didn't have the company support to actually go do a good job.
Right.
But the other thing might have been even a little bit of, you know, it's too much trouble.
You know, the really sad thing today is we see it over and over again. Journalism is no longer what it once was. Before, you had crews that were out on the scene actually witnessing and recording, you know, what was taking place. Today, you're lucky to get talking heads. And it's the same talking heads, you know, every hour. It's the same people. And they are experts at all different things. They just hire them in to talk. And the people are not getting an unvarnished sense of what's happening in our world.
And certainly no context to help them understand how it's
Absolutely.
All put together. There was a bit of talk about carbon removal from the atmosphere. Do you think that's a viable option?
The best carbon removal system we have is trees.
Which are also dying.
Which are dying, but we need to be planting trees. We also need to be using winter cover crops on our soils. When the pioneers settled in the United States, they turned over soil and it was black. It was black because it was carbon. That was carbon in the soil. 50% of the organic matter is carbon. And what happened was they mismanaged the soil and burnt the carbon out of the soil. 20% of the carbon that we have in the air right now, the human-caused carbon, is from our soils. So as we grow cover crops and do other things, we can restore that carbon year by year. And we need to do that. So I think the best carbon capturing devices are actually trees and soils.
What about diet? Some people are saying that the meat industry generates 15-20% of the emissions as well.
What we ought to be looking at is these feedlots, these concentrated animal operations where animals are put into enclosed systems where the waste accumulates, vents a lot of methane, causes a lot of other water pollution problems. And we really ought to be looking at our food system.
So if you were going to advise everybody listening to us right now, top five things you could do to make a difference.
Well, I think the first thing to do is look at your own home. And there are a number of things that we can do. I encourage people to produce their own food. You know, that's a very low energy input for food. I have a garden at home that I use compost in, and it's an important part of how I live. Change out your light bulbs. Don't even stop at fluorescent. Go right to LEDs. You know, reduce your own carbon usage. If you can afford a new car, I would get either a hybrid or if you can afford it, get an electric car or take mass transportation, live in urban areas. I mean, there's a lot of things that we can do in our own home. But I also think Americans need to take back America. You know, democracy does not function without the active participation of the voters. Ben Franklin, on his way out of the Independence Hall, was stopped, and a woman asked him, she said, "Sir, I understand you created a republic in there." And he said, yes, ma'am, we did, and it's yours if you can keep it.
Yes, I remember that.
And we're not keeping it very well. We're not doing our job. And so the fingers that we point at politicians, we ought to be pointing the other fingers back at ourselves. Yeah. We need to hold ourselves accountable as voters, to be informed, to understand what these people are doing. And it's very destructive. There's voter suppression going on now. There's a manipulation of voting districts so that people, you know, are basically carved out of the system. There's all sorts of things that are happening. We should demand that they change that behavior. And there are people who are clearly being oppressed by the bad politics that we're seeing.
And then finally, I wanted to ask you about something you wrote in your preface of your book, which is really essentially about how to live life and not taking on small battles.
Yes. My mentor is Ralph Abel, who was my Scout leader, and he was just a wonderful human being. But Ralph had landed on the beaches of Normandy, so he knew what a big battle was. He fought all the way through Europe and was a part of the liberation of one of the prison camps in Germany. But Ralph firmly believed that we should focus on the really big things and not get caught up in the details. And he used to say, Larry, don't fight any small battles because they don't inspire people. And, you know, I got involved in stopping acid rain in the 80s and 90s and now fighting the climate battle. You know, Ralph's been dead for 20 years, but I still hear his gravelly voice speaking to me, saying, don't give up this fight, to stay with it. And, you know, the persistence that he had during the Second War really inspired me. And so I see climate as one of those big fights that we must win. We hope we win. This is a must win for our children and for their children.
Well, thank you so much, Larry Schweiger.
Thank you.
The book is called Last Chance, Preserving Life on Earth. He is president and CEO of the National Wildlife Federation. Thank you so much for
thank
being
you.
With us.
It's great to be here.
When we come back, wildlife trafficking is a multi-billion dollar per year industry. What is the scope of the problem and what should be done about it? Stay tuned.
The drumfish, they beach themselves in Harukari. The blackbirds, they fell in thousands from the sky. Their red wings streaming down from the higher seas. Deflected by the ground, they crown the sun, they crown the sun.
They crown the sun.
They crown the sun. But I believe that they.
This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org, and I'm Maria Armudian. Despite efforts to preserve endangered animals, trafficking has increased in some parts of the world by an estimated 5,000%, according to conservationists. The poaching is pushing some animals, such as black rhinos and hippos, to the very brink of extinction. 46 countries signed the London Declaration, which works to end wildlife trafficking through law enforcement and cross-country cooperation. U.S. President Barack Obama has an additional national initiative that includes measures such as a ban on trafficked items like elephant tusks. Wildlife trafficking is a multi-billion dollar per year industry that has reportedly been used to fund Al-Qaeda-related groups. What is the scope of the problem and what should be done about it? Three experts join us. David Wilkie is a wildlife ecologist, a professor at Boston College, and the director of conservation support at the Wildlife Conservation Society. Tanya Wyatt also joins us. She is a lecturer of wildlife criminology at the University of Northumbria and the author of Green Criminology in Wildlife Trafficking, the Illegal Fur and Falcon Trades in Russia Far East, and Wildlife Trafficking, a Deconstruction of the Crime, the Victims, and the Offenders. Mark Beckoff is with us. He is Professor Emeritus of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology at the University of Colorado Boulder. He is co-founder with Jane Goodall of Ethologist for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. His books include The Emotional Lives of Animals, Why Dogs Hump and Bees Get Depressed, The Fascinating Science of Animal Intelligence, Emotions, Friendship, and Conservation, and Wild Justice, The Moral Lives of Animals. Welcome to the three of you. Thank you so much for being with us here on the Scholar Circle. I'd like to start with the scope of the problem. David Wilkie, what would you say we're facing?
Humans have been trafficking wildlife for millennia, and it's remarkable. North Americans actually ate passenger pigeons to extinction. There used to be flocks of 3 billion flying overhead, and we ate every single one of them. Well, the challenge is that we're doing this to more and more species as more and more of humanity gets to a level of wealth where we can all afford to buy things. And so tiger bones, tiger skins, leopard skins, rhino horns, elephant teeth are all trinkets that humans want for prestige or for other reasons. And with 7 billion people on the planet, demand for wildlife products is grossly outstripping the ability of wildlife to supply and meet that demand. So we're in a terrible crisis, and we're going to lose many species unless we do something about it.
As I understand it, the numbers are changing quite drastically and have become much worse, particularly with some of the animals, like you mentioned, tigers, rhinos, and elephants. Do you have a sense of how much worse it is?
Well, there's only about 1,600 female tigers left in the wild. That's a startlingly tiny amount. African elephants, we've gone from 1.5 million savanna elephants to around 300,000. We went from 800,000 elephants in the tropical forests of Africa to 80,000. So we've only got 10% of the elephants in the forests of Central Africa that we used to have. An unbelievable crash in the populations. It's very much the same way that whaling went. We lost almost 95% of our whales, and only when we found fossil fuels in Pennsylvania and started replacing whale oil for lamp oil did we actually save the whales. So we've got the ability to change the situation. We just need to have a global commitment to do so. And I think we've actually begun to see a sea change in the attitudes of the global community about wildlife trafficking. And Chelsea Clinton and Secretary Clinton have a huge amount to We've got a lot to thank them for actually pushing the global agenda on wildlife trafficking.
Tanya Wyatt, what would you add?
Well, I do think you see geographic differences. You have problems of demand in the United States, in the European Union, also in China and other areas in Asia, such as the Southeast. But then you also see, you know, the global South, we could say, as being the areas that are particularly exploited. Areas obviously in Africa, South America, and again in Asia that are targeted for their wildlife as commodities to be sold into more Western or areas that have growing middle class consumers. So there is a regional and geographic aspect to it that we need to take into consideration when we're developing prevention strategies.
Mark Bickoff.
I agree with everything that's been said. I think we need to have extremely strong enforcement of existing regulations, and maybe the existing regulations aren't really strong enough. I'm always amazed at the sheer numbers of animals who are involved. It's staggering when I read the reports of the millions of members of different sorts of species who are involved in the illegal wildlife trade. So it seems to me that enforcement is really important.
When you say millions of species, the ones we hear most about are the tigers, the rhinos, the elephants, the great apes. David Wilkie, I think you've also written about the great apes. Mark Bickoff, what are the other animals?
When I said millions of species, I was really thinking more the sheer number of individuals in a given species. But the exotic birds, for example, and reptiles who can be stuck in suitcases, for example, and you know, people try to smuggle them in. So that's all I was really referring to.
I see.
This is David. I was just out in Cameroon working with some colleagues of mine to think about how we might set up a conservation agenda for African grey parrots. It never occurred to me that African grey parrots are the most valuable pet on the planet. Because every African grey goes for $1,000 to $10,000 a bird. And we know nothing about them. We don't know about their ecology. We don't know where they feed. We don't know how many there are. They're social birds. They groom one another like primates. And yet we know practically nothing about their ecology. And yet they're the single most valuable pet on the planet. Isn't that startling? And I think this speaks to me about what the trade is about. 89% of Chinese consumers of ivory know that ivory consumption requires the death of an elephant. And 85% of those consumers will say they're going to buy ivory again.
Mm-hmm.
If just 10% of Chinese families who make $16,000 or more a year buy 1 2-ounce piece of ivory, that's about the size of a piece of soap that you get in a hotel. That requires 32,600 elephants to die. So the scale of the issue is unbelievable. And yet our ability to, our knowledge of the issue is waning relative to the scale of demand.
Tanya Wyatt, you have been looking at this. You've compared it also to the drug trafficking rings. You say the worst perpetrator is organized crime, but that there are other perpetrators. How would you describe this?
I would say that organized crime might have the largest impact in that they are capable of killing, frankly, more animals than maybe individuals. But you do have all the different levels of people that are actually involved in consumption and involved in demand. So you do have impoverished people that may feel forced to poach or to harvest things illegally. But I'd argue that they're probably having the least amount of impact or killing the least amount of animals. And you do have these larger criminal organizations that may be organized or maybe just structured rather than being our kind of stereotypical mafia kind of organized crime. And those are the kinds of criminals that we need to be worried about because they're the ones that are poaching elephants and rhinos in a very structured and systematic way.
And yet part of it, you mentioned, is also there are all these other actors that are part of the process, states, terrorists, corporations, insurgents. How do you see each of these actors as part of it?
Well, absolutely. It's certainly a long chain of middlemen that it's passing through as well. And states do have a role to play in that. There's arguably corruption is key in facilitating a good deal of wildlife trafficking, which is an area that needs to be studied much more. But corruption of customs, border patrol, police officers, but government officials as well that are facilitating it and profiting from it, that's a big part of it as well. And then there is anecdotal evidence that's becoming more substantiated that terrorists and insurgents are using wildlife, particularly ivory, sometimes timber, as a way to fund their kinds of conflict. And that, too, has a tremendous impact on the survival of these species.
This is David again, I couldn't agree more. I think that the wildlife trade and wildlife trafficking is just one other commodity that's being adopted by organized crime. They traffic arms, they traffic women, they traffic drugs, and now they're just trafficking wildlife. It's just another commodity. But to be honest, I think we've got incredibly powerful tools to tackle that part of the trafficking, the financing of trafficking. U.S. statutes for money laundering are about 20 years old, and it allows for the Treasury Department, the State Department, and the Department of Homeland Security to actually forfeit assets of people who we believe have gained these assets illicitly. It doesn't require the conviction of someone, it just requires the assumption that the assets have been obtained illicitly. And I think that asset forfeiture has huge potential for the U.S. and the European Union to take a bite out of crime in many ways.
In terms of the law enforcement side of things, do we know how effective these statutes are? When I worked in the legislature here, one of my first observations was we have good laws in the books, but we don't have them enforced. Is that the same situation here?
That's what I was saying, this is Mark, about enforcement. I agree that holding assets would be a very powerful tool, but it just, I don't know, maybe I'm a skeptic on it. It just seems the corruption is so widespread that's one of the reasons why it's so difficult to enforce already existing regulations or laws.
This is again David. I would agree with that too. But two colleagues of mine, Sam Strindberg and Fiona Meisel, looked at 10 years of data on the changes in elephant numbers in Central Africa. The results were devastating. It was a huge collapse of elephant populations in Central Africa. And they used really credible data to show that. But the upside of that was they showed that anywhere in Central Africa where rangers were actively patrolling, elephants survived. We know that good and effective ranger patrolling is a huge wildly successful activity to prevent poachers coming in and whacking elephants for their ivory. Regardless of corruption, it actually works. So we know that ranger patrolling works, and the conservation community has come together and developed this new consortium called SMART, which is to try and roll out the next generation of really clever tools to help eco-guards, rangers, park service people to do patrolling the most effectively as possible. And we've got credible evidence to show that that matters, that it makes a difference. Where rangers are patrolling, elephants survive. Where rangers aren't patrolling, elephants disappear. So, yes, corruption is a huge problem, but we've got some tools that can actually make a difference.
I had read that a lot of technology was being developed in a way that could also aid in the enforcement of these laws, technology that is actually controversial in other ways, such as drones. Is this actually being developed for conservation purposes, or is it just far off into the future? Tanya White?
Andrew Lemieux is another colleague of mine, and I believe that they have been actually testing drones in Uganda, is at least my sense of it. So I do think it's maybe a bit further along than we would have guessed.
This is David again. Yes, UAVs are actually really useful. And to be honest, they're useful for two reasons. UAVs or drones let eco-guards, who are typically far less sophisticated and armed than the poachers who they're against, it lets a ranger patrol figure out whether people that they're hearing at a salt lick, are they hunter-gatherers who've got legitimate reasons to be there, or are they illegal hunters who have got AK-47s and RPGs and could... So drones help rangers save themselves from getting into a firefight and actually getting killed. So I think drones have huge potential to increase the safety of ranger patrolling. And drones also have a huge potential of reaching out, allowing a ranger patrol to patrol a far larger area than they would on foot. And this is particularly important in the forest. So yes, we are actively using drones to extend the reach of eco-guards and to protect eco-guards from bumping into much more seriously armed individuals and much more ruthless individuals who are poaching ivory.
To me, then we're more on the ground, because at the beginning we were talking, you know, just about corruption and enforcement of regulations and holding assets, which I think is really a great idea as well, but I think it's really very difficult to enforce. But I love what you're talking about in terms of local types of control. When I was in Kenya, I mean, I talked to some people, and one of the points they made was, you know, in some ways the people doing this are just trying to survive. And you can pay them to kill animals, or you can pay them to protect animals. And it's not that they're nasty people. It's just they're very poor, and they need an income. So I'm liking the idea of, you know, acting locally and thinking globally, if you will.
Well, that brings up a case study that Tanya Wyatt did. Tanya, you did this case study about Cambodia and some of the efforts they've made there that seem to have had an element of success.
Well, I think it's similar to what Dr. Wilkie was talking about of NGOs that have been quite progressive and have years ago realized that rangers do make the difference in protecting species. And so I was an intern and have written about Wildlife Alliance, you know, fundraising and paying the salary of rangers to go in and actually do these patrols and protect these areas. And I do think that they've had some success. It's very promising of not only preventing poaching, but then also rescuing animals that have been poached and rehabilitating them and hopefully returning them to their habitats.
It sounded also that there was an education program there in Cambodia that was really teaching people about the ecology and about the need for biodiversity. Was that also part of it?
Yeah, that's a great program that the Wildlife Alliance has developed there, that they have a van that they drive around to the more remote villages throughout southwest Cambodia and really focus on young people and go into the grade schools and to children that are around the age of 6 and 7 and teach them the value of conservation and biodiversity and how we need to protect our environment, which is really the age we need to be targeting to kind of change the entitlement that some people feel to consume wildlife. And so I think it's a great program, and I do think that they're showing some success after years of doing it.
I love the idea of working with youngsters. I think it's really the key, one of the big keys to the future.
Just a reminder that you are listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're talking about wildlife trafficking, the problem and the potential solutions. David Wilkie?
One of the interesting things is that wildlife trafficking is a destabilizing thing. It's usually outsiders coming in and taking the resources of local people. Local people don't like that. They don't like it because it's their resources. They don't like it because it increases violence and instability and insecurity, and that's not good for development. So one of the neat things that's happening as mobile phone and cell phone coverage extends is we actually have the capacity to have anonymous whistleblowing that allows for local people to say, hey, you know, I've noticed some weird stuff happening in my neighborhood. And to me, this sort of crowdsourced intelligence networks, again, have huge potential to extend the reach of law enforcement. And law enforcement always sounds bad. I think of it as crime prevention. To me, if I say crime prevention, everyone likes it. If you say law enforcement, it sounds more like a fascist state. But crime prevention through crowdsourcing, to me, has huge potential of changing the game. Because local people don't want armed militias coming into their neighborhood and shooting the critters that they could potentially make a profit on through tourism or something else.
One other thing that I saw in one of your papers pertained to really the buyers of certain products. Now, this was specifically, I think, about bushmeat. But you had found that as the prices went up really high, the consumption went down quite a bit. Is there an answer on that side as well?
Well, bushmeat's a necessity for many people. It's a source of dietary protein. So that's different from a luxury good like ivory or rhino horn. So the economics of the trade is fundamentally different. When you drive the price up of a necessity, people will look for a substitute. There is no substitute for rhino horn or elephant ivory, and that's the trick. And that's why ban on sales and burning caches of illicitly harvested ivory is so important. I'm really looking forward to Tanzania burning their 122 tons of ivory. That means that ivory will not leak back into the market. Public crushing or burning of ivory sends a huge message. And I think that the Obama administration, by banning ivory sales effectively in the United States, is going to encourage China and Vietnam, the two largest consumer nations, to think really hard. Do they want to be international citizens? Do they want to be a part of the international community? And it's going to put enormous pressure on those governments to do something about the ivory trade.
Let's take a look at both President Obama's task force and also the London Declaration. Mark Beckoff, have you had some time to digest what has gone on?
Sort of. I did. I think that what has gone on is a really good move in the right direction. And I work in China a bunch with one of the Moon Bear Rescue projects, and I love the people there, but I'm not so optimistic about change there, not because the people are necessarily heartless, but just because the sheer numbers and the sheer money involved. That's what I've heard from people there working in other areas of animal protection, is that it's just so hard to get your foot in the door just because of the numbers and the money.
Tanya Wyatt?
They have followed. I read the National Strategy for Combating Wildlife Trafficking coming out of the U.S., and then I was at the International Wildlife Trafficking Symposium that happened before the conference in London, and I'm encouraged that it's on the political agenda and it's finally getting attention that probably the three of us on the panel have been talking about for years. So it is encouraging. I probably would share some colleagues' reservations, though, that I worry that it could go the path of being too militarized and paramilitarized, and we have the same kind of battle that we had with the war on drugs, to where we just throw lots of money and lots of law enforcement at it, and we don't actually make the changes on the ground to provide people with alternative livelihoods and things that need to be done to really stamp out the problem. But hopefully all of that will come into play as well as efforts increase.
So you see part of the missing components as really an economic component for people to have an alternative to this process.
I do, yes. That's how we help local communities to not poach and not harvest things illegally. You've got to tackle demand. Yes, there's crime prevention, but there's also changing the paradigm of how we view wildlife can be consumed. And that's the most challenging task ahead for us.
David Wilkie, how would you assess the international community's efforts?
Now, what I'm absolutely startled is the marvelous mobilization of international interest and support for the ivory trafficking issue. I agree with everyone on the panel that we need to tackle wildlife trafficking. It's a trade good, so we need to tackle it along the commodity chain, from the source points where poaching is happening to national transit, to international transit, to the consumers. We need to tackle all the way along the supply chain, absolutely. What we've learned with China is really interesting. We thought that we could use campaigns that have been very successful in the United States and in Europe, using movie stars or sports stars as spokespeople for the trade. When we actually interviewed Chinese ivory consumers, we said, you know, if Yao Ming, this wonderful, really tall basketball player, said, don't buy ivory, would that change your impressions? Would that change your opinions? 3% of ivory consumers said that would change their ivory purchasing behavior. 37%.
That's interesting. Yao Ming is a very strong supporter of the Moon Bear Rescue Program I work with.
And he's fantastic. He's a marvelous advocate.
Yeah.
But 37% of Chinese ivory consumers said if the government banned it, they would stop consuming ivory. 25% said if Politburo members said that it was inappropriate to buy ivory, they would stop buying ivory. I think one of the things we really need to do is understand the consumer. And we're getting a better handle on that. And we're getting to understand how we can use social media, how we can use pressure on the governments to change behavior. And that's a significant difference to 9 months ago.
Mark Beckhoff, one of your edited volumes on conservation, asked a question in an important way. It said, who lives, who dies, and why? How would you answer that today?
It was in my book, Ignoring Nature No More, The Case for Compassionate Conservation. And there's essays in there that talk about the wildlife trade. I think individuals are making that decision. What they just said, I didn't know those data. And I think about American advertisement, you know, where LeBron James says something and the stock in a company goes either up or down significantly. I didn't know that about China. But I think the people who are making that, answering the question, who dies, who lives, who dies, and why, are really the locals. And that's why, like I said before, I'm not saying much new right now, is getting to them in whatever way. So if they can be influenced by government policy or what Politburo people say, that would be the way I go. But I also don't think that people realize that they are basically making that decision. And that's why, you know, the who dies, who lives, who dies, and why has sort of become my little bumper sticker. And when I talk to people about it in terms of other issues with non-human animals, it actually gives them pause, because that's basically at issue. We are making these decisions about the lives of individual animals.
Tanya Wyatt, one of your studies also looked at how birds are being smuggled in Oceania, going from Australia to New Zealand and then getting trafficked out. Given New Zealand's reputation for actually protecting the environment and other species, does that become part of it? Are countries like Australia and New Zealand then going to have to crack down on this?
They're definitely hugely involved in the international discussion around wildlife trafficking. The John Scanlon, the current Secretary General of CITES, is Australian, and those people have been actively involved in it. And New Zealand's an interesting case because they were the first, really, to come up with a wildlife enforcement network. So they were good in predicting that this was going to be an issue. It does obviously come down to funding. They've had trouble maintaining the resources that are going to those units. But I think Australia is actually a good example, because they have much stricter CITES regulations than other countries. And I think that's why, in part, why they've managed to keep their amounts of illegal trade so low. And as I've written in that article, it might be wise for New Zealand possibly to consider having stricter CITES regulations as well, and the UK as well, because it does tend to be a hub here in London for illegal trade.
David Wilkie.
The charismatic species always get the headlines. The pangolins, the seahorses, the sharks, critters that people either think are slimy or unpleasant or dangerous don't get into the headlines. And I would just like listeners to understand that the wildlife trade is rhinos and elephants and tigers. but it's a whole host of other species that are being overexploited because 7 billion people is a lot of demand. And we can no longer feed off the planet. We can no longer eat off the planet. We can no longer just take what we need. 89% of the terrestrial landscape is dominated by humans. That's a lot. Humanity has to decide if we want to save things or not. And for my children, my children's children, I want elephants to be there. I want rhinos to be there. I want sharks to be there. I want seahorses to be there. I want a future where my great-great-grandchildren get to see what I see. And thus, we need to fix the wildlife trade.
Mark Beckoff.
I agree. I'm so influenced by Ed Wilson. You know, Wilson, he had a great quote about how really ants and the insects are the animals with whom we should be concerned. And since I've studied social carnivores, I mean, I love them and they are charismatic, but he basically really has convinced me that somehow we have to have people become aware of the incredible importance of the non-charismatic animals. And, you know, there's a size thing there, too, because a lot of times they're the ones who can be put into a suitcase. You know, you can't put an elephant into a suitcase, but you can put a lot of little animals into a suitcase or into a backpack and smuggle them. So in my own work, I try to stress that, you know, especially with kids, take them on hikes and take them on walks and have them focus on the little animals who they think are slimy and ugly and, you know, the ones to whom they go, ooh, I wouldn't want that animal around me.
Tanya Wyatt.
No, I would agree with both of them, with Dr. Beckoff and Dr. Wilkie, enthusiastically, that we need to have that shift that wildlife is not just instrumentally valuable to humans, that it's intrinsically valuable and beautiful and has its own right to life.
Absolutely, Tanya. I couldn't agree more with you.
Thank you for joining us here on the Scholar Circle.
Great. Well, thank you
very much for inviting me to join this conversation.
David Wilkie is a wildlife ecologist, a professor at Boston College, and the director of conservation support at the Wildlife Conservation Society. Tanya Wyatt is a lecturer of wildlife criminology at the University of Northumbria and the author of Green Criminology and Wildlife Trafficking, The Illegal Fur and Falcon Trades in Russia Far East, and Wildlife Trafficking, A Deconstruction of the Crime, the Victims, and the Offenders. Mark Beckoff is Professor Emeritus of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology at the University of Colorado Boulder. He is co-founder with Jane Goodall of Ethologist for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. His books include The Emotional Lives of Animals, Why Dogs Hump and Bees Get Depressed, The Fascinating Science of Animal Intelligence, Emotions, Friendship, and Conservation, and Wild Justice, The Moral Lives of Animals. Thanks to all who made this program possible, Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin, Cuauhtemoc Aleman, Sad Dongre, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page. Most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed a part of the show, you can find our archives at scholarscircle.org. Please like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Armudian. See you next week.